Bonk.
Hello.
Hi, we're currently sitting in a podcast fort.
Yes, we're in the fort.
We are in the podcast fort, the Pafort.
Fort Clementine.
Yes, Fort Clementine is where we are right now, in a mobile home in North Carolina.
Yes, in the marsh of North Carolina.
We are in the sticks, the marsh, the swamp, however you want to refer the natural surroundings of where we are at. We're now sitting underneath, we've made a makeshift fort of sorts,
mm-hmm.
a sort fort, and it's two recliners back to back with blankets over it. And still here, it turns out in a mobile home, it's difficult to get away from air conditioners and refrigerators and things like that because they are smaller. Mobile
mm-hmm.
homes are smaller. And we were sitting at a giant table. Then the fridge turned on and screwed everything up. So hopefully you can hear us. But if things sound a little bit different than you're used to from the Pizone, we are on the road, on location,
right.
Talking about this here show. But our time here in the trailer... The trailer. What's more fun to say, the trailer or the mobile home?
I mean, when you hear trailer, it makes it seem way more, like, way smaller than it is. I mean, I know
yeah.
it is, like, it's not like a small trailer. It's not like a trailer park trailer.
And it's not an RV either.
No.
It's a mobile home. It could conceivably go on the back of a large truck. But
I
it's a
guess.
Big, yeah, yeah you
mean,
can move it.
It's kind of, I guess, a double wide, technically.
Yeah, you slap an oversized load on the back of that guy and you can move that down I-95, right?
I don't know.
You probably have to have a special license for that, I would imagine.
Carry houses around?
I think so, I'd imagine. Or to drive a big old truck like that. So, being the mobile home, I was going to say it has afforded us time to binge a show. But ultimately, it's not time that we wouldn't have had at home. We weren't really going around Connecticut painting the town red. We were... I don't know why it feels like we've had more time since we've been here. Because
mm-hmm.
really, I'm still working my normal hours. You're still working at your normal hours. I mean, we weren't leaving the apartment much anyway during these quarantine times. So I don't know why it felt like so much easier to binge three seasons of a television show.
I think maybe just the setting alone is, like, perfect. Like, let's cuddle and watch something, binge something together. And now we will always associate this entire show thus far with North Carolina.
Yes, and the show in question is Search Party.
Indeed.
And this is a show that the first two seasons aired on TBS before getting picked up by HBO Max, and HBO Max debuted the third season. This is a show I had not really heard about until, like, recent weeks or, like, maybe a month ago. I heard some people raving about this. It was around the time that HBO Max launched
mm-hmm.
that I heard people being like, oh, my God, it's been 2 years, and finally, season three, we get to find out what happens. I hadn't heard anything about this beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I vaguely remember it being, like, advertised on TBS, but I obviously never watched it. I never heard anyone talking about it. But, I mean, Alia Shawkat, I think she's pretty great.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I was always very curious about the show, the fact that they just put out a season three on HBO Max. Usually when that happens, like, the fact that they would put out another season on, like, a different platform shows that there is, like, a devout fan base, obviously, that they wanted to appeal to. I mean, if there was no fans, then they wouldn't have done the third season. They wouldn't have, like, resuscitated it, essentially.
There has to be a demand for them to make a whole
totally.
Other season.
Yeah.
And then to launch a new subscription service with it as, you know, one of the original things.
Like, right.
Season three is the only one we saw with a stinger at the top saying, like, an HBO Max original.
Mm-hmm.
So this appears to be fully HBO at this point.
Right.
I don't know what conglomerate owns TBS. I don't know if it's the same as HBO. It's all a giant mess right now, and we don't have cable, so we don't see a lot of cable commercials for things like TBS or whatever. We're a streaming household here on Panning the Stream.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really glad that we caught onto this show when we did, because I think if we had to watch it week to week and wait months in between seasons, if not years, it would have been tough. Like, this is a very, very bingeable show.
Yeah, the episodes are pretty short, too. They're only, like, what, like 20, 25 minutes?
Yeah, and there's a pace to every episode where it's like, I never felt in the three seasons of this show like I was like, all right, get to it, or this side plot's boring me, or whatever. Like, a lot of, like, long shows that you can binge, it's just like, okay, I'm tired of, like, this side plot. Even, like, Breaking Bad and 24 are some of my favorite ones, have whole sections where it's like, okay, I don't care about this Kim side story or this Walter Jr. thing going on.
Yeah, I agree. It's way more focused, the show. I mean, pretty much the whole, it's called Search Party because they are, in the first season, searching for this girl who goes missing.
Chantal Witherbottom.
Yeah, and it's one of the things I noticed, like, as we were watching it, how I remarked on, like, how every episode, at least in the first two seasons for sure, always ended on a cliffhanger. And you made the point that, like, well, yeah, if it's on regular TV, they want to keep people watching. Whereas, like, if it's Netflix or a binging situation where you can just watch it nonstop, there's less of a reason to, like, hook you at the end for more episodes, because you're probably just going to watch more anyway.
Yeah, it's right there.
And looking back on the whole, the entirety of the show, I mean, there's going to be another season, but all of what's available now, if you look at, like, season three, I don't think it does that cliffhanger stuff as much as, like, I feel like every episode doesn't end on as oh my god, I have to see what happens next kind of thing than
yeah.
the first two seasons. I mean, we'll get into the third season more, but just, you know, in its totality, just noticing immediately the difference between, like, the show on a streaming platform versus the show that was on TV.
Yeah, it would hint at little things at the end of season three episodes, but it wouldn't be like, oh, you got to see what happens immediately mm-hmm. after this moment, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
So let's just talk about what the show is in general to start here. It is, I would say it is part satire, mm-hmm. part thriller. It's kind of a satire of just like kind of self-absorbed millennial cool kid New York City culture, mm-hmm. wouldn't you say?
Yeah, yeah. Like the, I mean, and in a way, like most teen dramas in general, where like everything you do has to have some kind of significance and meaning, because really everything they do in the first season, all the efforts to try to track down Chantal, nothing really goes anywhere.
It doesn't, and especially with the way things wind up at the end of the first season, but it all kind of comes from this, like, kind of malaise that, so Dory is Elias Shawkat's character, and she just kind of, like, is directionless. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know what to do with her life. She kind of feels like, if this all starts with her having a conversation with her friends about, like, where she realizes, oh, if I went missing, like mm-hmm. this Chantal did, would anyone give a shit? Because, like, Chantal goes missing, and they're all kind of sitting around talking about it, like, oh, yeah, I remember her from college. What was the deal with her? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like, they all act like she was nothing, and there's not even anything worth remembering. And Dory's right. kind of like, oh, shit, is that what I'm going to be like? If I just disappeared off the face of the earth, would anyone give a shit?
Right.
And so she's just, like, on the hunt for, like, anything, a career. You know, she's going to these interviews and
something
stuff.
Something to do.
Yeah. And she just kind of feels like she's existing in New York City. And so her and her friend group are all kind of, I would say to differing degrees, very self-absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Dory, who Dory is just more kind of just, like, I think, anxious and depressed. You got her boyfriend, Drew, who I thought at the beginning of the show he was going to be absolutely insufferable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the first few times we see him, he's just, you know, playing this ukulele and singing these dumb songs and just, like, being, like, total, like, stereotype hipster dude. I think, actually, by the end of the show, from the core four friends, he's maybe the most likable one.
I wouldn't go that far.
Who do you say? Would you say Dory?
The most likable? Probably Portia ends up being the most likable. I mean, she, if you think about it, she's the one who kind of didn't really do anything that deserved, you know, being put on trial and stuff like that. And she was the most innocent of the group.
That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's, so her thing is, she seems like kind of deeply insecure, kind of like an airhead, a little bit ditzy, but like ultimately, I guess she's a bit narcissistic and naive, but not an outwardly bad person.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the other people in this, the core four friend group, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens.
Elliot is, like, a total egomaniac who, like, is just a pathological liar. He lies about having cancer when he was a kid, and this is a story that he's constantly bringing up, too. So it's, like,
yeah.
one of his defining characteristics is that he overcame this cancer, but it never actually happened.
Yeah, and trying to, like, profit off it, like, trying to, like, launch this designer water bottle thing under the guise of it being for charity, but ultimately it's all for his own ego mm-hmm. and wanting to get rich, and he's just, like, total kind of rich kid. Well, actually, he's not a rich kid, which we find out later
on. Well, yeah, that's one of the things that confused me a little in the show. I mean, it does that thing that, like, shows used to do, which I feel like we were kind of, I don't know, people are more aware of things now, to where you can't just have these young, attractive people living in an amazing apartment without some questions being answered. I mean, like,
yeah.
Drew and Dory live in this awesome apartment. Portia and Elliot have this amazing apartment. And, like, it turns out that Elliot, like, it's kind of implied that his family has money. If not, it's outright said at one point. But it turns out his family doesn't have money. So it's really confusing how he has the means to live like that. And, you know, Drew is just an intern. Dory
yeah.
can't really get a job. She spends all her time hunting Chantal's whereabouts. So it's, like, unclear how they're able to afford the privileged millennial lifestyle that they do, but...
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, if we didn't learn more about the characters, we could just assume that all of them were living off of, like, mommy and daddy's money, you know? But we do kind of learn more about pretty much all of their families, mm-hmm. and they're not all... Actually, Portia's parents seem, like, legitimately pretty well-to-do. Or her mom. Her dad died. Right. Yeah. Dory works for Gail, who is Christine Taylor, Ben Stiller's ex-wife, who has been in a lot of Ben Stiller stuff. I remember seeing her on Hey Dude back in the day. I used to love that show as a kid. She's great in this. Gail is, her whole thing is, like, she is definitely, like, a rich, bored, like, upper-class wife in Manhattan.
Yeah, married into a ton of money. Like, she often, like, at one point she says to, Dory that she's attractive, so all she has to do is find a husband and her life will be easy. Like, she's one of those just, like, stereotypical rich housewives of like the Upper West Side or whatever.
Yeah, and, like, generally well-meaning, you know, but, like, clearly troubled and lonely, and she's got some issues with, like, pain meds and drinking every night. And,
yeah, very just, lonely. Yeah. Yeah.
But ultimately, like, I liked that character a lot, and I thought Christine Taylor did a really good job with that. You know, she was, like, fun in pretty much every scene when she wasn't, like, you know, passed out and mumbling from pain pills and stuff like that. So basically, there are three seasons of this, and I feel like every one of the three seasons had a very defined feeling and theme to it, which mm-hmm. I really like. Like, I think about, like, the show is nothing like The Wire, but The Wire did a thing where every single season was like, this is the one where we're dealing with this, the docks, and this one is about the schools, and this one's about this. This one, every season is very much focused and has kind of a beginning and end that leads into the next season. So season one is all about Chantal disappearing mm-hmm. and the friends deciding, mainly Dory. Dory gets, like, obsessed with, right. I need to find
and
Chantal.
And the friends are kind of indulging her.
Yeah, and, like, to the point where, like, Dory's getting deeper and deeper into it, and the friends are, to different degrees, just being like, hey, maybe you should drop this, especially Drew.
Right, yeah, because she's, like, to the point where she's, like, acting really risky and, like, spending a lot of time with this private investigator who was supposedly, as far as she knows, hired by Chantal's family to investigate her, because Dory kind of, at a, like, vigil type of thing, confronted the mom, and so she believed that they were being, you know, that she was being stalked by this PI that was hired by the family. Turns out that's not the case. But, you know, she invades this cult that's really dangerous.
The Bellow and Hare cult.
Yeah, that was a really funny, interesting part of the first season.
Yeah, Parker Posey plays this woman, Brick, that basically it seems like this, like, designer art boutique store or something. And it turns out it's, like, this weird pregnancy cult. And so there's, like, all these, like, really colorful, weird things around. It makes you wonder, like, oh, man. Like, there is, like, kind of a whodunit where it's like, okay, somebody must have, like, mm-hmm. kidnapped Chantal. I can't wait to get to the bottom of this. There's a Gavin, you know, Chantal's ex-boyfriend, who's
Gavin,
really weird.
There's apparently, like, a secret pregnancy.
Yeah. She finds a sonogram. She's like, oh, okay, so she must have gotten pregnant. Maybe Gavin got her pregnant, and then she ran off or something. Right. Like,
and then to top it all off, Dory, like, knows that Chantal's alive because she sees her at, like, a Chinese restaurant, not eating, just, like, sitting weird with this guy, and she has, like, a book. She has Anna Karenina, and, like, yeah, it's weird. Like, a lot of clues that ultimately, you know, lead them to Chantal's location, but it doesn't end up being this big, you know, mystery that they're unveiling. It turns out at the end of it all that, at the end of the first season, that Chantal, like, willingly disappeared because Chantal, the best part about the whole Chantal thing is that she ended up being, like, kind of super shitty and annoying. And
she sucks. Like, I hated her.
Yeah, like, causing her family so much stress and grief over her just wanting to, like, just get a rest and take a break from everything.
Yeah, she basically, Chantal had, like, an affair with a married guy, and it went bad, and they got in a fight in the woods, and she took off. But, like, all these things that look like she got killed or kidnapped are all explained through, like, oh, she, like, they were having a picnic in the woods, and she, like, kind of fell on these wine glasses, and that's why her blouse had blood on it and stuff. So, yeah, it's basically her just being selfish and not telling her family and just kind of, like, fucking off somewhere.
Right.
And so she's around for the next couple seasons, and she really sucks.
Yeah, she sucks.
She's incredibly – she's very, very dumb, very annoying, very self-absorbed, kind of lies a ton.
Right.
Everyone on the show is lying all the time. Everyone. Even, like, the cop that comes in later, like, that's investigating things. Like, everyone is lying. That's a through line for sure. So Keith Powell is the private investigator you referenced, mm-hmm. and That is the guy that played the lead in Office Space.
Ron Livingston.
Ron Livingston, yeah.
I think he was in Sex and the City, too.
Oh, okay. So him and Dory start kind of working together. He's just like, hey, I'm working for the family. You got to help find Chantal here. But he's getting, like, concerningly attached to her where she fucks up. And, like, mm-hmm. they're, like, looking for clues one night. And, like, they get really excited because they think they found something. And they start just, like, making out and they sleep together.
Right.
And so Dory has to lie about this to Drew and everything. And Drew finds out. And this turns into a whole rift between him and her that mm-hmm. kind of, like, remains to different degrees throughout. But, yeah, it's really cool because they wind up going to Montreal, the friend group does, to look for Chantal. Because the whole long thing, we're not going to, there's a lot of twists and turns and reasons that things happen. We're just going to cover some broad strokes here. But they wind up in Montreal at this big empty house, basically.
The friend of Chantal, like family friend, is kind of housing Chantal in this big empty mansion in Montreal.
Yeah. And so she's just kind of like hanging out in a room there. And they get up there. They see evidence that Chantal has been there, but Chantal's not there. So it's just the four friends kind of hanging out here. And at one point, Portia wants to like go out to the bars, basically. She's just like, it's like, okay, I just want to go out and, you know, see the city. She's just getting some cabin fever, right. basically. So it leaves the three of them there. And then there's a part where Keith Powell comes in the house. He, like, breaks in the front door. And it's great because it's at a time where, like, Elliot is in the backyard, like, worked on a book deal thing or something. I don't know where Drew is. But there's a sequence where, like, Dory is, like, hiding around the house. It's almost like Mr. X in Resident Evil 2 remake where it's, like, because they build Keith. Like, at this point, we don't know what Keith's deal is. We don't know if it's something more sinister. We just know, like, they are afraid of him and there's, like, a mystery around him.
Right.
And so it's almost like him just kind of stalking around while, like, Dory's hiding in places and stuff. And it's kind of a scary, like, there's a lot of thriller elements.
Yeah, I think at this point, Dory knows that Keith wasn't hired by the family.
Yeah.
So she's very suspicious of him, and he's kind of getting a little obsessive after they slept together and everything.
Yeah, a lot of, like, constant texts and stuff like that. And,
yeah,
like,
so just him turning up at the house out of nowhere after she, like, specifically told him, like, oh, they're going to Miami, because, you know, she wanted to send him in the opposite direction, but then he turns up there. Which, it turns out that he had, like, a tracking device on her car, which I feel like wasn't addressed enough, but
yeah, he was doing, like, I feel like with what happens later, there is probably more evidence they could use to make Keith not look like this innocent victim of what's about to happen here. So basically, he is approaching her in the kitchen, Dory, and Dory just kind of panics and thinks that she's under attack, basically, and she tases him. And Keith kind of falls on top of her, and he bangs his head on the way down, and he's, like, bleeding on Dory's face. It's this whole fucking scary thing, and she has no idea what's going on. Drew comes in, has no idea what's going on, just sees this guy on top of her, and he grabs this, like, obelisk, this award, and just conks him on the head.
Right.
And Keith's dead. Like, he's just bleeding out on the ground.
Right, which at this point, you know, I mean, it was obviously self-defense. They should have just called the police and been like, hey, this happened. We didn't mean to kill him, but I thought I was about to die. But instead, they decide to hide his body, bury his body.
Yeah, it's because of Elliot, because Elliot, you know, it's almost like he's very familiar with lying and how to do it effectively. And so he starts asking a lot of questions like, okay, Dory, so did you do this or was he attacking you or did, you know, asking a bunch of questions. And when she answers honestly, Elliot's kind of like, yeah, that's not going to fly in court. Like, this is going to look really bad for us. We have to try to, like, he's kind of the one that convinces them to, like, let's hide this. Yeah. And there's just an amazing sequence. Like, this is all in the finale, and it's great. There's a sequence where, like, he's dead or dying, bleeding out on the floor, and Portia randomly comes home from the bars with some random, like, French-Canadian guy named Mathieu.
Mathieu was there earlier. I think at this point, she was in the house, but she was just, like, came for a glass of water in the kitchen or whatever.
No. I'm thinking of the part where she came back with Chantal from the bars.
They were hanging out at home the whole time, remember?
Oh, so Chantal was there when the murder happened?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there was an amazing sequence where I wrote down an amazing sequence where he's dead or dying. Oh, I think he's maybe in the closet at this time. And, like, they're all just like, holy shit, we just killed a guy, and they shove his body in the closet. And then, like, Portia comes home with, like, Mateo and Chantal.
Oh, right, and then, yeah, that's right. They go to the bar after,
after
they kill him. And then
cocaine and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, and they want to be up all night, like, doing coke and stuff like that, while the other three are like, holy shit, there's literally a body just, like, rotting in a closet right now. It's just a really, really tense, great finale here. And it picks up immediately with season two, where it's like, okay, so that's the end. Season one was finding Chantal. We found her. There's no mystery there. Mm-hmm. Which, what a cool, like, payoff's a weird word for it, but it's like, what a cool conclusion to that, because you expect with all these weird, you know, pregnancy cults and this shady private investigator and everything, that you think it's going to be some big, crazy thing, but it's nothing.
Right. I think the show does a really good job, too, of, like, depicting or illustrating how it must feel, like, for someone that's not a murderer to have killed someone. And, like, you can't escape it from your thoughts ever. It's, like, constantly haunting you. Like, every conversation is dominated by it. You can't ever remove it from your mind, which I feel like if I were to accidentally kill someone, that's obviously what would happen.
Oh, you'd be thinking about it nonstop. You'd be dreaming about it every night. And it's, like, they touch on that a lot in season two, where they're just, like, sitting around in the car, or they're, like, you know, some of them will try to just kind of forget it and not deal with it. And some of them are like, oh, yeah, I read that. You know, it takes a few years to get past murdering someone. So we just got to wait this out. And, you know, it's even like they're all self-absorbed and narcissistic and kind of shitty in their own ways. But they're all fucked up by this.
Right. Yeah. Tell. And season two, I feel like, kind of focuses on them trying to cover their tracks and build the story and just avoid detection and suspicion. And ultimately, it culminates, obviously, in them getting arrested for it. But yeah, it's a very extremely tense season because you never know what they're going to throw at you next. There's, like, this detective who's, like, really, like, kind of really on to them. And then there ends up being this, like, mob guy that they use to misdirect. Like, Dory just ends up making up this fake name, Fat Frankie, who ends up being a real guy. And, like,
winds up getting shot by a cop.
Yeah, and then he has a wire. So, like, she tells a story about him threatening her, but it turns out, like, she just, like, accidentally shot him.
And he was an informant, too. He was, like,
so that's why, like, I was wearing a wire,
Yeah, like, every situation is so terrible for them because there's a mountain of evidence against them. Like, there's no way they're going to get away with this. But they're having to go into these, like, really awkward situations. Like, there's this, like, whole, like, key to the city ceremony they want to give her in Chantal's hometown when they all know they're, you know, completely guilty. Mm-hmm. You know, Agnes, the girl whose aunt or whatever had the house, she wants the obelisk back. Right. She's like, why is that missing? Like, you got to give that back to me right away. There's a guy named Julian, he's a journalist, and he can tell something's fishy, so he's investigating stuff and knows there's lies going on. Dory sends an email, like, breaks into Keith's apartment and sends an email from his computer, which looks really weird, and because he was already dead at that time. It's just like everything's going terrible.
Right.
And then I really liked it in the latter half of this season where these threats start showing up, where it's clear somebody knows what's up.
Right.
Like, these flowers show up at Drew's work that say, like, hey, you know, congratulations on killing someone. Mm-hmm. They come home one day and murderer is on the door in red paint. And it turns out it is this downstairs neighbor named April who is pretty hilarious throughout the show.
Uh-huh.
She's kind of just, like, hovering around the show for the first season and a half or so. She's, like, tries to seduce Drew hilariously at one point. She's just kind of, like, nuts. Like, it all starts because Drew and Dory think that she's getting beat because they can hear. You can hear really well.
Right.
Actually, now that I think about it, they established that the ceiling was very thin because they hear the fight they were having. Drew checks on her. And so it turns out all the time that they're having these long discussions about killing Keith Powell, April's down there. And she apparently records things all the time, too. And so she knows everything, all the details. And also, April has a twin sister named June in the show. Did you know that's a different actress?
What?
Yeah.
Are they actually twins?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I thought that, like, I just thought they did a little bit because their faces look a little bit different. Yeah. And I thought they just did a little bit of prosthetic or something.
I didn't even notice that their faces look different.
I could tell them, because, like, one of them is, like, really happy and one of them is really just kind of, like, not evil, but just, like, angry all the time.
I thought that was just acting. I didn't notice that they actually look different.
Right. But, yeah, it's two different, it's sisters, for sure. So that winds up being a big thing, is her trying to, like, do a ransom to get, you know, basically, I've got this evidence on you. I'm going to turn it in.
And then she wants money to keep it
To
herself, yeah.
And that leads to, near the end of the second season, the second kill. And this one's a much more deliberate one, where Dory shoves her off the Staten Island ferry, where they were meeting to kind of exchange the money and the evidence.
Yeah, but it turns out April really sucks, and no one really cares that she's dead anyway.
She does super suck. I keep waiting for her to come back up. Like, during these three seasons, I kept thinking she was going to come back up. I thought she was going to be alive. And she could be. It seems like they intentionally left it. Like, there's never a funeral. There's never, like, oh, we dredged the body.
I feel like if she comes back, it's going to be so, like, I don't know, that'd be pretty cheap, but
you think it'd be too much?
I mean, they show her falling off the boat.
Yeah, like, and she's not near land. Like, and she's, like, near the, I don't know, propellers or whatever the fuck a ferry does.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, and so season two ends with Dory getting arrested during the senator's acceptance speech. That's a whole kind of side story that, you know, don't need to cover. But, yeah, so she gets arrested, and that is season two, is the attempted cover-up, and it does not work out.
Right.
Yes. And then season three...
Well, the reason they get that she gets arrested is, like, there's some anonymous tip, right?
Yeah, yeah, so there's an anonymous tip, and so at this point, let's talk about where all the characters are at. Dory is arrested. Mm-hmm. Drew gets arrested while trying to flee to Shanghai.
Yeah.
He's on a plane. Cops pull him off. Portia is, like, kind of, like, just trying to find herself. And, like, she's got herself caught up with this, like, real shithead, like, play director mm-hmm. guy. And she, like, confides in him, you know, as a mistake. And that winds up being the anonymous tip, basically.
Right.
It's through that. And Elliot, at this point, what is he doing? He is...
Well, his book deal went south.
Right. Because he didn't want to work. He just, I love the part where he's just like, I just don't like working. It's just too much work.
Well, him and Portia both get arrested as they're, like, going back home, remember?
Yes.
Yeah.
But then they wind up, like, because they're not on trial at any point, you know?
Right.
Like, Portia kind of straight up flips and says, like, here's what happened. You know, we were there together. I didn't kill them, but, right. you know, like, and then Elliot, they just decide wasn't, like, worth it or something?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not on trial, right?
Yeah, I forgot what the deal is with Elliot, but yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, the whole thing that bothered me a little bit was, like, they make, Dory, obviously, something happens to her, she kind of descends into this, like, evil psychopath, right? But, like, she actually wasn't the one to kill Keith. Drew killed Keith.
He swung the obelisk that killed him.
Yeah, which was weird. Also, the murder happened in Canada, so the trial should happen in Canada.
Oh, I guess that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, there's some things in season three that bother me a little bit. I don't think it was the strongest of the three seasons.
Yeah, I don't think it was bad by any means. There are some, like, logic holes, and there are things that, like, maybe you would think are going to go somewhere that don't really have a big payoff. Like, even the whole thing with the Fat Frankie thing and the cop, like, that doesn't really go... I'm trying to think, what was the ultimate conclusion there? Like, they just couldn't... The cop was barking up the wrong tree,
Yeah, there's a lot of things that makes you think, like, oh, this is probably what's going to be what gets them out of getting in trouble. Like, oh, the Fat Frankie thing will end up, like, you know, the attention will be on him instead. But then it turns out he's an informant. It was recorded, so it's proven that he had nothing to do with it. You think that, like, when Drew sleeps with that juror, like... later on that
doesn't go anywhere, does it?
That'll end up, like, she'll have feelings for him and keep them from, you know, convicting, but then she just gets kicked off the, you know, she gets replaced, so that doesn't go anywhere. And the thing that, like, after their friendship is kind of destroyed in a way, after Portia testifies against them, the thing that brings them together again is there's this stalker that ends up, like, kidnapping Portia. And that's kind of like a Deus Ex Machina thing. It just kind of comes out of nowhere, the whole stalker thing. It kind of widens in its scope in the third season more. It's not as singularly focused, and there's a lot of, like, kind of logic holes and stuff like that a little bit, and it's not as realistic as I feel like the first two seasons maybe were, or the first season especially. It just becomes a little more absurd, I think.
Yeah.
It's still very enjoyable, but, you know, back-to-back, watching them in quick succession like we did here, you could see, like, the differences between the seasons.
Yeah, and it's not clear, like, which ones were intentional red herrings to make you think a certain way, or which ones were just, like, throwing in a bunch of different little twists and stuff that don't go anywhere. I remember one thing that I thought was a little much, because, like, you know, the show is, I'm not going to say it's, like, grounded in reality. You know, it's a pretty fantastical show at times. But I thought the whole, like, April and June thing was kind of like, okay, yeah. We're doing the surprise identical twin thing. Like, and ultimately, I don't know if that was necessary. Because right. All she really adds to it is, okay, now April has someone close to her that is following up on her disappearance.
Right, yeah, that's another thing. Like, it ends up, April has this diary that you think is going to be, like, another way that people find out that Drew and Dory killed Keith. But then it ends up that it's written in some weird language that only these twins understand, so that's pointless as well.
Yeah, so if they don't wind up going back to the April stuff, which I would think they would have to at some point in season four, we'll see. But, like, a lot of stuff surrounding that just doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
And even the stuff that we referred to with, like, there's the senator and there's this, like, sexual blackmail thing with Julian, the journalist and stuff. I feel like there's a decent amount of time dedicated to that side plot that doesn't really, like, it is the reason they met on the ferry and stuff like that, but it seems a little contrived, you know?
Yeah, like, I could see, you know, they framed it as like, oh, well, Dory will use this money to blackmail the senator and get, or use the photos that the senator sent Julian to blackmail her and get the money to pay April, but that doesn't even end going anywhere. It ends up, like, Julian just gets paid directly from the senator and
goes to Brazil.
Yeah, he goes to, like, Portugal or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's a.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. I kind of like the idea of, like, you get this whiplash a lot with this show about, like, oh man, which way are we going with this? Because it does lend it a certain bit of unpredictability. Mm-hmm. But also, it's like there are a few things that just, like, oh, what's this? Oh, nothing. Okay, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I just felt like things mattered more in the first two seasons. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of the third season, though, was this lawyer, Cassidy yes. Diamond.
Yes, she is amazing. Turns out she's, like, got some connection with, like, Gail and Gail, the woman that Dory worked for. And it's like, okay, well, they'll put up the bail money to get you out, but you also have to, like, have their daughter be your lawyer. And
right.
She's never done an actual case before. And she's doing this incredibly aggressive, like, vocal fry thing the entire time.
Yeah.
And, like, all of her motions whenever she says everything, like, she absolutely killed it. I've never seen her in anything. She was great.
She was really funny.
And then we also have Louis Anderson showing up as Bob Lunch, the lawyer for Drew. And he is just so weirdly aloof in this. Like, I don't even know how to describe him in this season.
Yeah, he's just weird, like, weirdly creepy. Like, no one really wants to know what his deal is, so no one asks him any questions, but he's kind of just offers up random bits of pieces that are just like, what?
And he doesn't seem good. And, like, Drew's dad hires him. He's like, oh, he's the best lawyer in Chicago, 1989, or something. He's like,
yeah.
Whoa, how is he now? And he just seems just so... He's, like, referencing how he's going to be dead in a year, but we never know why.
Yeah, like, well, he ate a bunch of, like, lead paint chips when he was a kid.
That's right. But it's like, Louis Anderson plays it so well. He just has this kind of, like, distant look in his eye the whole time. And, like, the stuff he says is super weird. I thought the him and Cassidy interacting with each other and being the, like, defense team was,
yeah.
was a great dynamic. Also, Michaela Watkins, who had a very short run on SNL in the late 2000s, she plays the prosecutor, Polly.
Mm-hmm.
I've always found her very funny, and I think she plays this, like, really kind of, like, uptight but good prosecutor who's just, like...
I didn't recognize her from anything. I didn't know she was in SNL.
She had one of those SNL runs that was, like, a year or two long and got a few sketches on the air and, like, just kind of disappeared. But she's been, like, she's bounced around a lot of stuff, been in, like, episodes of Curb and stuff like that. So I've always found her funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was great in this as the one, like... She's just intensely logical, and there's so much bullshit happening around. Specifically, there's this part where the tape gets kind of restored,
mm-hmm.
and there's a part where they clearly say, like, we murdered Keith Powell. And you hear it says, we murdered Keith Powell, and then it's like, okay, we'll play it again, because the bailiff's like, it sounded like she said we pancaked Keith Powell. And then Michaela Watkins like, wait, what? No, why? Okay, I guess we'll play it again. And then it's funny because they actually, like, clearly changed the audio
right.
for the show. And I said, we pancaked Keith Powell.
Right.
And it's just one of those, like, blue dress, white dress things.
The Laurel thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, where it's like they have to, like, make it inadmissible because nobody knows if it says pancaked or murdered. And, like, Louis Anderson is looking up Urban Dictionary about how, like, pancaking a girl is doing this sex act. And, like, oh, we can't, you know, try them for having weird sex. that was really weird and funny.
That was funny.
Another highlight later on in the season is the wedding of Elliot his boyfriend Mark, which is just the most extravagant thing with, like, child actors playing young versions
of
them.
It's so insane, and it's, like, ridiculously expensive, but they end up having sponsors, so they don't have to pay for it. Like, sponsorships from these companies that, like, want to show their unity with, you know, the LGBT community, and, like, they do it by endorsing this gay wedding, and it's just so over the top and insane.
And like, Mark no-shows at the, like, leaves him at the altar, but they're, like, contractually obligated to, like, party until midnight or 11:59 because of all the sponsors.
Right.
And Portia singing I'll Make Love to You just over and over and, like, being very theatrical about it. And they're all just waiting for Mark to come out, and she just keeps repeating the chorus. Love that. And so this is kind of where the obsessed fan kind of comes in. That's something they were teasing at the end of a lot of episodes, where this guy gets Dory tattooed on his knuckles, and he basically, like, poses as one of the caterers and kidnaps Portia, douses her in honey,
mm-hmm.
and then, like, basically is going to have rats eat her. Dory and her bodyguard and stuff that she's hired show
right.
up at the last second, save her. And I thought that was going to be the end of that, and I was kind of, like, ready to be like, well... That's weird that they ended, like, three or four episodes in a row with teases about the stalker,
mm-hmm.
only to have him, like, go on the run and get hit by a car.
Right.
And at one point, Drew thinks he's dead. And I was like, is that the end of that? That was the whole story?
He, like, calls the hospital and they say he's dead. So that was confusing to me.
Well, it's interesting because, like, the way this ends, and we'll talk about that in a second, he's going to be a big part of season four. And Elia Shawkat has been saying in interviews that since they already filmed season four, she was like, oh my God, they go incredible places with him. And she's like, the actor playing him is a genius. And it's just some, like, really, really great stuff with him. So I am very curious to see where this goes, even if it was kind of weird this season.
Right.
God, there's a little subplot where Elliot has, he's actually from this, like, redneck family. And at one point he, like, just leaves and goes down to visit them, and he's on this bus going through, like, rural areas, and the guy next to him is smoking. This is maybe one of my favorite jokes in the whole series. Guy next to him is smoking, and Elliot's like, you know, you can't smoke on here, you can't smoke on the bus. And the guy's like, yeah you can. He points to a sign at the front of the bus, and it has a, it's like the no smoking sign,
right,
but it's just a green circle around that same cigarette, and the text says, you can smoke. It was like, say puedo fumar or something on it. It's just like, the idea that they made a, yeah, go for it, smoke, like, encouraging it. Oh, that killed me.
My other favorite joke was, like, way earlier when it was, like, shortly after they killed Keith, and Dora's, like, walking around, and she sees this, like, puppet show on, she sees, like, these people gathered around this, like, street puppet show, and she imagines that it's, like, Keith or something, and she screams, and then everyone looks at her, and she was like, it goes back to the fact that they were just plain puppets, and she was like, oh, I'm sorry, I thought they were real.
Yes. Yeah, it's the timing, the humor. The executive producer is Michael Showalter from The State and Stella, Wet Hot American Summer, all that. So the writing and directing has just been, it's so, so good. Mm-hmm. So sharply made. Like, the comic timing on everything. And also the performances. Every single person they cast, from the main cast to the side. Like, you've got people showing up in really fun, like, side roles. We talked about Parker Posey, you know, Louis Anderson. Wallace Shawn pops up. Rosie Perez. Michael Showalter plays a character in there. Like, everyone is absolutely great in this.
Yeah, the acting is incredible.
Yeah. And the end of season three is the verdict comes. Dory fires Cassidy and represents herself for the closing arguments and does a big teary, you know, like, I'm the victim here thing, and gets the jury on her side, and they get acquitted. And then the big twist at the end is that she's got a shaved head and she is, like, super chained up somewhere, like the stalker got her,
right,
basically. So that is definitely, you know, if each season has its own thing going on, season four seems like it's going to be, oh, a stalker has kidnapped Dory.
Yeah, everyone's going to be searching for Dory, so it'll come back around on the search party
part. I didn't even think about the search party part. But yeah, he's, like, filming stuff, and so it's probably implied that he's going to, like, send out the videos, and they're going to know she's alive and all that. So I'm very excited. And knowing that, I was worried, because I knew it took a couple years for season three to come out, and I was like, oh man, is it going to be a couple years before we get to watch this, especially with coronavirus and everything, and them not being able to film? Turns out they got it all on the can, like, a month before everything locked down.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be soonish,
right,
you know, which I'm very, very excited about the season four of this. I thought it was so effective as both a comedy and a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really think of many other things that struck this balance that well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the first season especially, and then subsequently, it's more just like, how are they going to get them? Because they kind of, it doesn't do it like, well, it very purposefully wants you to not sympathize with Dory and Drew. Like, they kind of, you know, especially Dory ends up being this evil kind of media whore.
Who's kind of getting into it, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So they don't necessarily want you to root for her, but it ends up being, like, an exercise in, like, okay, how are they going to get got? And the fact that they don't. But ultimately, like, the prosecutor says to Dory, like, she gets her karma, you know, comes back to her in the form of her getting abducted by that obsessive guy. But, yeah, it's interesting. I'm really curious to see where they go with it, for sure.
Yeah, and I don't think in all the years we've known each other, we've ever binged a show like this. Like, we watched all of The Jinx in one night, and that was, like, 6 hours or something. But, like, this is three seasons that we binged through in, like, 5 days or something.
A little more than 5 days, right?
And we started watching right when we got here, I'd say from, like, the 8th to, like, a few days ago. I think we went through it in, like, less than a week.
Well, that first night that we watched it, I feel like we watched most of the first season in one night.
We watched, like, 8 episodes or something.
Yeah,
the first
yeah.
Night.
So that we did a lot then. But yeah, like I said, the episodes are short. It's really easy to get through.
Yeah, and even with, you know, little nitpicky, you know, things about, like, the later season and stuff, it was still great.
Mm-hmm.
I was still totally into it every episode. Made me laugh out loud numerous times an episode,
yeah,
but
yeah,
also
for sure.
Had to know where things were going, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So, hell of a show. If you have HBO Max, or if you just want to sign up for a trial and binge this, this is a real good way to use
Definitely.
That trial time.
Definitely.
But yeah, that'll be it for our chat on Search Party. And we also want to make sure we thank all of our patrons, patreon.com/paintingthestream.
Thank you, patrons. Thank you, patrons.
Yeah, she wrote a whole song for you, patrons. And we got, on top of that song, we got some other benefits. We got, what do you got? You got the early episodes. You get them on Saturday instead of Sunday.
Early.
All your episodes are going to be ad-free.
Nice.
You're going to have access to the Discord that's shared with my Twitch viewers.
It's a great community.
Records Mart, great community. And also, you're going to get your very own personalized, written for you by Bonk. Bonk who?
It's a Bonk who for you.
Bonk, who's it for this week?
Maria.
Maria, hello.
Maria, hello, Maria. I wrote this Bonk who for you, and I hope that it brings you joy. Maria noticed that time and space collided whenever she cried.
Jeez. Is that a superpower?
Maybe.
There's a question mark. There's a implied question mark at the end of every Bonk who. Maria, thank you for your support. I hope you enjoyed your Bonk who. Also, we normally do the Hugue game at the end of each one of these episodes, but I forgot to pack the Hugue game cards on the way down here. But Bonk, I believe you've produced one out of the ether?
That's correct, Daniel.
Okay.
Here's the question. Where is the worst place that you have been stuck in for a long time?
Oh, that's a great question. Did you come up with this, or did you find this somewhere?
I found it.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, boy. What's yours?
Well, thinking about it seems like laughable that this would be the worst place I was ever stuck, but it's the first place that came to mind, which is when I was like, my first long-term boyfriend was like at the end of our relationship, kind of, so things weren't going well. And I was over his house and I went to leave, but he had like a weird driveway, and when I pulled out, my car got stuck. And, you know, it had to be, like, dug out. And he insisted that he could do it himself, but he clearly could not. So I had to call my brother Dan, who came and, like, and Stacy, his girlfriend at the time, now his wife, came and, like, it just ended up taking forever. And it's just, like, I just wanted to get out of there so bad. But I think I ended up watching Jurassic Park with Stacy, so it ended up not being so bad. But, yeah.
That sounds rough.
The first thing I could think of, but...
First thing I think of, I don't know if this counts because it's not technically one place, but it was New Year's Day, I'm going to guess 2011, 2012 or something. Okay. And my ex-girlfriend was a flight attendant. And so as a result, when we started dating, she's like, yeah, it's going to be great because, like, you know, we can have up to 5 people on this list and you can fly for free as much as you want. I was like, wow, that's awesome. And so the first time we were going to use it, I went to her hometown in Michigan for New Year's. And so, you know, it was New Year's night. We went bowling with a bunch of her friends and stuff like that. So I'm very, like, hungover and stuff. And on top of this, I forgot to get my shoes at the end of the night. So I'm wearing bowling shoes.
Oh,
and
no.
I wake up in the morning and I need to get to the airport because I need to fly home. She was flying off working somewhere else. So I was going by myself going home. I get to the airport, realize on the drive there that I'm wearing bowling shoes. And it's too late to go back and get my real shoes, leaving them in Michigan. And when you are on this list, when you're close to a flight attendant, what you have to do is you have to fly standby, which means you kind of stand by the gate and you, like, right when everyone's boarding, you have to wait until, like, the plane is about to take off, basically.
Right.
And you look at the board and you see, like, oh, these are the people on the standby list that get to get on the plane. So it's a very tense thing of, like, okay, I'm here with my bags. Do I get to get on this plane? And I didn't.
So if, okay, go ahead. I'll ask my questions later.
Okay. So I was not able to get on the plane. And so then it's like, okay, great. Now you got to go to the Delta or whatever gate and explain the situation. And they try to find a different way to get you home.
Okay.
And so they were like, okay, you can either wait, you know, a day and a half and get on this flight. And I had to get back and get to work and stuff. And I was like, I can't wait that long. And they're like, okay, well, we'll get you on this flight to, like, Philadelphia right now. So you're going to go from Michigan to, like, Philadelphia. And then you'll try to get on a connecting flight back to Minnesota. And I was like, all right, if that's the quickest way, I guess I'll go east for a couple hours before going back, whatever, just get me on a plane. So I go to Pennsylvania, I land there, and then I have to wait standby trying to go back to Minnesota.
Okay.
Again, bowling shoes, hungover, not feeling great. And I didn't get on that plane.
Oh, no.
And so then I was like, what the fuck? And then I have to go again. They sent me down to North Carolina, down to the Raleigh airport.
Oh, no.
And so I get on a third plane to Raleigh, and I think it wound up being like 4 planes in a day, and like so many times of sitting there, and just like when you see that like the gate closes and you weren't on the standby list, it's just like, are you kidding me? Like, oh, I'm just in bowling shoes, hungover, like, just get me to Minnesota, please. So that's mine.
So you ended up, so the North Carolina flight took you to Minnesota.
I think, yeah, there were like three or four total ones. And it was just like, I just remember like sitting on a plane, hungover, looking at these bowling shoes and just like, oh, I just want to be home.
See, that to me, it wouldn't be worth that uncertainty and the added time.
I don't think I ever did it again. Yeah. I think it was the first and last time. I was just like, hey, I know that's on paper a cool perk that you get to fly anywhere, but like, this way is not the way to do it.
Yeah,
I'd rather pay a few hundred bucks and just go to the place.
Totally.
Yes. That's fine.
That's rough.
Yes. But if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at PanTheStream. You can give us the 5 stars on Apple Podcasts if you'd be so kind and you're feeling inclined. Thanks to Dom Manda for the theme song.
Thanks, brother.
And we'll see. We got a couple more days left here in North Carolina. We will see if we wind up recording another road episode in this little podcast fort or if we record the next one back at home. But either way, we will be back with another episode for you next week.
See you then.
Bye.